This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Joe Biden and Xi Jinping had that big meeting. All we got was six lousy minutes to talk about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 17th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is one of those weeks where the politics of this economy, this one here in this country and the global economy as well, the politics of it were front and center. We shall discuss with an economic framing with Anna Swanson. She's at the New York Times. Amara Mokwe is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, you too.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Anna, let me ask you, first of all, you were in San Francisco for the APEC summit, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
okay.
Right.
So this meeting, specifically between Biden and Xi Jinping, but also the general vibe there, it was not necessarily about the economy, but come on, it was about the economy.
Yeah. It's been a very interesting vibe here. There were government-to-government meetings between Biden and Xi, a lot of other meetings between leaders of Pacific nations. And then I also went to a pretty interesting $2,000 plate dinner that the business community hosted for Xi Jinping this week. So, you know, very interesting vibe. I mean, I think overall the U.S. and China did restore some stability to their relationship, but it feels really fragile. Both the U.S. and China were signaling that they want to keep doing business in non-sensitive areas. That was a big signal coming out of that that dinner with Xi Jinping shaking right. hands with Elon Musk and Tim Cook. And they also reached some other agreements on military to military talks, China stopping chemicals that make fentanyl. But, you know, overall, it was just about putting the countries on a slightly better footing. And, you know, that, of course, has very important implications for both economies and the global economy.
So two things here, just as a follow up. Do you think, as Janet Yellen has talked about and others as well, do you think they put a floor under this relationship? Have we hit bottom, as it were? And number two, and related, what do you make of the fact that Xi Jinping got like three standing ovations from the CEOs at that dinner?
Right. So, yeah, I think there is sort of a floor under the relationship. I mean, it had been kind of in free fall with the balloon crisis. The country's defense secretaries weren't talking to each other at all, you know, which is kind of scary, given the size of our militaries. The U.S. and China did restore military to military cooperation. They're signaling that some business is okay. I think there is a floor there, but it does feel really like tenuous. And, you know, there's a lot of X factors that could still throw things off. Xi, I thought, was really interesting. I mean, this is a man who, you know, firmly believes in putting the Communist Party ahead of business, has this kind of iron grip over China that is scaring off foreign business. But yet, you know, some businesses really want to be in China still and are making a lot of money in China. And I think you see also that China really wants foreign investment and has been concerned by foreign investors leaving the country.
Right. All right, Amara, lest you think we had forgotten about you, here comes the turn to the United States, right? So Biden goes into this meeting stronger economically than Xi Jinping does, right? Because the economy here is robust and strong by many measures. The Chinese economy is not. Inflation numbers this week, inflation basically flat month to month. Here's the question. Just because you wrote about this in the Journal this week, How close do you think we are to actually knowing whether we're going to hit a soft landing? And what is that going to look like?
Yeah, so I think there is growing optimism that we are going to get the soft landing. And it was really notable as we went into the CPI report. A lot of economists were talking about how they thought the report would show that sort of the last mile, as they call it, of the Fed fighting inflation would be really difficult. And then as we came out of the report, the tone had totally shifted and everybody was like, this shows that, you know, the hardest part is over, right? That the Fed has really made progress and that we could actually get this soft landing. And I think if we do get it, it's going to look a lot like what we're seeing now. We're seeing inflation moving closer to where the Fed would like it. We're seeing a labor market that has cooled substantially, but that is still adding jobs where unemployment is still pretty low. We're seeing consumers continue to spend. That has cooled a little bit too, but generally speaking, still on solid footing. So it's looking like all the ingredients for a soft landing are here now.
Let me ask you this, though, Mara. How worried are you as an observer and a reporter on this economy that Congress is going to mess it all up because there are government shutdowns perhaps looming? The Republicans in the House have their own ideas about how to fund this government, and there's a total lack of agreement about how to run this economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a big concern. And you see what the ratings agencies have been saying recently about the U.S. fiscal picture, the fact that we have ever-rising debt, the fact that we have ever-rising deficits, and that there doesn't really seem like there's good governance in Washington to deal with some of these issues. So that's definitely a concern. They did reach a deal on a continuing resolution, but that only kicks the can down the road. And so in a few months, we're going to be right back where we were just recently, wondering if we're going to get a government shutdown. So that does pose a risk potentially going forward.
On a pick a thing to watch over the next, you know, till the shutdown, till like the end of January, what are you looking at?
Let's see. That's a tough question. I mean,
so is it a labor market thing? Is it a consumer thing? I mean, what, you know, what's the tell here on this economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're going to be watching, you know, the strength of the consumer, particularly going into Christmas. There's been a lot of, you know, uncertainty about that. That has been an engine behind the economy. And of course, you know, we're going to keep closely watching, the inflation reports and seeing if, we are on that, soft landing path that we were talking about. But yeah, I think maybe, you know, the Christmas spending will be a very interesting and telling one to watch.
Amara, last thing to you, and it's I tried not to talk about the Fed a lot the last couple of weeks because Lord knows we all talk about the Fed too much. But I think we're going to talk to Austin Goolsbee in a week or two from the Chicago Fed, and so I'll ask him this question as well. But since you're here now, I'm going to ask you, what's the Fed waiting for to actually come out and say, you know what, we're done now. We're just done.
Well, inflation is still high. It's not at their 2% target. And I think they, you know, Chair Powell has talked about this before, how they've been head faked, where they thought inflation was moving in one direction and then it sort of, you know, reared its head again. And so I think they're just waiting to feel like very convinced that inflation has come down and that it will stay down.
Amara Mokwe at the Wall Street Journal, channeling Jay Powell, Anna Swanson at the New York Times, channeling Joe Biden and Xi Jinping and $2,000 a plate. Thanks, you two. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
On Wall Street today, you know, traders might as well have taken the day off. Things were so calm. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. Sometimes, especially with technology, it's the little things that get noticed, and oftentimes those little things are worth a whole lot of money. So you pick up your phone to text somebody, a friend, family member, colleague, doesn't matter, and you can tell right away whether that person is in the club or not. They're either a blue bubble in the text thread, that is, an iPhone user, or a green bubble, not an iPhone user. The text dividing line, though, is about to blur. Apple says that sometime in 2024, it's going to make it easier for iPhone users to connect with Android users. It is a big shift to the vaunted Apple ecosystem that over the years has brought that company's products a whole lot of clout and a whole lot of cash, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
If you're an Android user, maybe this feels familiar. You reveal you don't have an iPhone, and then comes a sideways glance, a big sigh, or a kind of joking, kind of not threat to leave you out of the group text.
You know, a lot of times, if someone's not an Apple user, you look at them a little differently.
Dan Ives owns an iPhone. He's also managing director at Wedbush Securities. He says Apple created a luxury product, and people don't have to flash the actual phone to show they can afford it. They can just text.
That's unique to what Apple has created. And for them, they've been able to further monetize that.
Through Apple's closed hardware system of products like iMessage, iTunes, and Apple Podcasts.
Now, Apple's come under fire for doing it.
Eric Seufert is an independent analyst. His text bubble is blue. He says Apple argues the closed system is for privacy and security, but plenty of companies, like Spotify and others that use Apple's App Store, say that system is anti-competitive.
And what they've done with iMessage in particular is kind of deteriorate the experience for Android users that want to message their iPhone-owning friends.
The EU is in the middle of an investigation of Apple's iMessage. Seufert says Apple is probably trying to get ahead of a potential mandate to make messaging interoperable. The software update will allow iPhone and Android users to message over Wi-Fi and share photos and videos more easily. Oppenheimer analyst Martin Young, who is, you guessed it, also an iPhone user, says iMessage itself doesn't make money for Apple, but its cultural cachet does. And losing that exclusivity could affect business.
I think it has a particularly stronger impact on younger users, and it can influence how younger users choose their first phone.
That's important because once someone's in Apple's ecosystem, they're unlikely to leave it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We track the labor market in this economy a bunch of different ways. Jobs added or lost, claims for unemployment benefits, first time or continuing, wages and how many people are quitting, just a lot of different ways. Also, how many people are working or actively looking for work? That is reflected in something called the labor force participation rate, and like so very many ways that we measure this economy, it can vary quite a bit from state to state. Data out today show Utah has the highest participation rate in the country, Mississippi the lowest. Why? Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall got that assignment.
Utah and Mississippi, two states with roughly 3 million people, but very different labor force participation. So what is that exactly? Economist Mark Nold is with the Utah Department of Workforce Services.
Anyone 16 and older has the potential to be in the labor force. If every single one of them either worked or looked for work, you would have 100% participation in the labor force.
But in Mississippi, the labor force participation rate is about half that. State economist Corey Miller says many are too sick or injured to work.
That's one of the main factors, particularly among men of prime working age.
The low level of education is another factor.
Our population share with a bachelor's degree, age 25 and over, is about 10 percentage points below the rest of the nation.
In Utah, there's a labor force participation rate of 70%. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a big influence on that. Economist Peter Phillips is with the University of Utah.
That is a religion with a culture and a theology that encourages family formation.
That means higher birth rates.
It has an effect on the entire age structure in Utah, and it's striking.
And high birth rates have led to a younger, healthier workforce. Economist Mark Nold again.
You have more younger workers coming in than those aging out.
He says labor force participation has grown in the past year.
It's the teenagers, and it's also the 55 and older workers.
He says while some older Utahns are returning to work to earn more as inflation has driven up prices, teens who may be competing with several siblings for mom and dad's cash are deciding to earn money of their own. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I have been learning how to ask for help more.
Absolutely nothing wrong with that. Everybody ought to do it. First, though, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrials flat today, 34,947. The NASDAQ added 11 points, less than a tenth percent, 14,125. The S&P 500 picked up 5 points, about a tenth percent, 45.14. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 1.9%. The NASDAQ up 2.4%. S&P 500 added almost 2.25%. A full spread for your holiday table is running about 4.5% cheaper than last year. That's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. Every year, it asks shoppers nationwide to price ingredients for menu items, including stuffing, sweet potatoes, rolls, peas, cranberry sauce, pumpkin pie, and of course, turkey. Who has peas on Thanksgiving? Come on, man, how to ruin a dinner. The survey found that the bird at the center of the table is running more than 5.5% cheaper than last year. We'll do bonds real quick. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.43%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Congress has once again and almost despite itself avoided a government shutdown by once again kicking the can down the road. We are going to revisit this legislative aversion to making tough decisions about government spending again in January and then again in February, thanks to the creative way that Republican Speaker Mike Johnson has decided to fund the government, relying, it has to be said here, on Democrats to get it done. Whatever's going to happen after the first of the year, though, is going to be pretty much the opposite of bipartisan. There's a line item, though, in the farm bill, which, for the record, expired in September and has yet to be reauthorized, that irks both conservatives and liberals. The federal crop insurance program, which helps make farmers whole when they lose crops or revenue due to things beyond their control. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has today's episode of our Every Now and Then series. There's a government program for what now?
The Environmental Working Group is considered a pretty liberal group, and it has a lot of problems with the USDA's crop insurance program, which paid out more than $19 billion last year, the most ever.
Only 20% of farms in the U.S. actually participate in the crop insurance program.
Ann Schechinger is an agricultural economist with the group. Unlike traditional insurance, where buyers pay a premium that goes into a pot to cover any losses, farmers only pay about 40% of their crop insurance premiums. The other roughly 60% is paid by the federal government, aka taxpayers. And, says Schechinger,
the majority of crop insurance money goes to just four main crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, and cotton. And a lot of the money, 65%, goes to farmers in just 10 states.
Conservative groups also have a problem with crop insurance. The American Enterprise Institute and Taxpayers for Common Sense argue that with rising deficits, a program that costs upwards of $10 billion every year and climbing due to climate change, is ripe for a review in the next farm bill. Chris Edwards is an economist at the Libertarian Cato Institute.
Crop insurance reduces risks for farmers, but why can't farmers reduce risks by themselves in the marketplace, such as diversifying their crops, diversifying their planting locations?
Edwards says when farmers know their losses will be covered at a subsidized rate, they may farm in ways they otherwise wouldn't, like continuing to grow water-intensive crops in areas plagued by drought. Billy Hackett is a policy specialist at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition and says crop insurance as it exists today tends to benefit wealthy farmers with large farms.
The federal crop insurance program works very well for a small group of farmers. And the farmers who are left out are small farmers, beginning farmers, BIPOC farmers, farmers growing fruits and vegetables.
So groups across the political spectrum are calling for a fresh look at the premium subsidies when Congress takes up the next farm bill, especially those going to wealthy farmers, because right now there are no income limits for who gets subsidies or caps on payouts. But farmers who do use the program build their business models around it. Mark Wilson co-owns Wilson Legacy Farms in Smyrna, Delaware, with his brother.
And we're overlooking about 170 acres. We'll go 2 years corn, then we rotate into wheat and soybeans.
The Wilsons won't say how much they pull in every year in crop insurance payments, but for their 6,000 acres across 50 farms, they say the program is a necessary tool for managing expenses and keeping food prices low.
People that complain about crop insurance, if they want the farmers to assume their own risk, if they're ready to pay $25 a pound for beef or $10 a gallon for a gallon of milk, take the government out of it, and then you'll see what happens.
That's one of the arguments made by those who want to maintain the program mostly as is. Barrett Nelson is an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
Farmers are capable of managing some of the risks, but there's a lot of things outside of our control.
Like record-breaking heat, drought, extreme weather shifts from climate change that alter the land faster than farmers can adapt.
And that's what that safety net is for, to make sure that the farmer can come back the next year and the year after that.
Congress gave itself until next year to craft a new farm bill, so expect more discussion of the winners and losers when it comes to crop insurance and the balance of risk between farmers and the rest of us. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Retail sales slowed just a little bit in October, another sign the economy is cooling. But timing being everything, this is happening just as the holiday shopping season really gets kicking into gear. Black Friday, so named because, perhaps apocryphally, it's when retailers get into the black for the year. Black Friday is just around the corner. So we are following three of our retail regulars throughout the holidays to see how things go for them on the business side and on the personal side. First up, Kalina Bruce. She runs Noir Lux Candle Bar in Seattle.
We are in the height of our busyness. And so we have a lot of folks that are booking their holiday parties and those sorts of things. I think that the feeling of being prepared is never really there in terms of the holiday season. We try to anticipate what our needs are going to be, and we try to order in bulk and order ahead of time. We're definitely running into a lot of backstock items. One of our main vessels that we use, we've ordered it forever since we've been in business. It now has been backstocked for like 3 months. That's kind of the, you know, interesting predicament that we're in right now. Sadly, my mom actually passed away unexpectedly 2 weeks ago. So we are having to process that. It's been really challenging because my mom was a staple here at the shop. I have a staff member who's here today, and we were just talking about, okay, how would Miss Patty do this? Like, what do we need to do so we can keep up with how she kept us in check? People ask about her all the time. I sent out a newsletter just to kind of try to let people know, just so we can articulate it. But I mean, yeah, people are just like, it's unbelievable. I have been learning how to ask for help more. I think that's really hard for me, especially just because with this business specifically, I grew it from something that was really small to something that has been bigger than just candles. And so I take it very personally. And I know that I have an amazing team that I can trust and lean on. And so I have to do a better job of leaning on them. So I am working on asking for help. I'm working on practicing a better work-life balance and just taking some time. I think that, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup, and I have to fill myself a little bit more so that I can be a better, you know, a better boss, a better business owner, a better mom, all those things. So yeah, that's how I'm hoping to prepare to have a really good holiday season.
Kalina Bruce, taking care of herself and her business, Noir Lux Candle Bar, up in Seattle. This final note on the way out today, a very public firing in the very high-profile business of artificial intelligence. Sam Altman, the founder, CEO, and head cheerleader of OpenAI, the company that brought us ChatGPT, has been ousted by his board of directors. Here's the relevant passage from the press release. Mr. Altman's departure follows a deliberative process by the board, which concluded that he was not consistently candid in his communications with the board, hindering its ability to exercise its responsibilities. The board no longer has confidence in his ability to continue leading OpenAI. CEOs get fired all the time, not usually like this. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. It's Census Bureau data analyzed by Bloomberg. A record number of homes in this economy, and thus homeowners, are mortgage-free, just under 40%. Not surprisingly, perhaps, more than half of those mortgage-less owners are of retirement age. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Vargalli. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.